From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Noe Valley.
Napa, California.
I live in the Castro Fillmore District.
Bernal Heights.
Oakland, California.
Coming up, we'll see how San Francisco's newest public school is doing 1 year in.
We have such potential here at Willie Brown to making sure that we do right by these kids, and I can't say that we've done a good job yet.
Then a Bay Area playwright explains why she loves to write stories about scientists.
If you think about what drama is, what makes a great play are these moments of discovery, moments of surprise, and that's really science.
And we learn the story behind this week's Audiograph Mystery Sound. Making some noise today on Cross Currents. Stick around. Summer is almost here. That means San Francisco's newest public school is wrapping up the end of its first academic year. Willie L. Brown Jr. Middle School is the only non-charter public middle school in Bayview-Hunters Point. 60% of the kids in the school's inaugural sixth grade class live in the neighborhood. For a long time, the odds have been stacked against these kids. Data from 2013 shows that almost 70% of youth in the area have been exposed to at least one adverse childhood experience, also known as ACE. Children with four or more ACEs are over 30 times more likely to have learning or behavioral problems in school. Plus, there's a history of segregated schools there. The NAACP sued SFUSD twice in the 1970s for failing to adequately desegregate schools. So last year, following a lot of publicity and promotion, SFUSD opened this new school, hoping it could address some of the needs of the families in the neighborhood. KALW's Nina Gensler-Debs tells us more.
The end of the year appreciation dinner at Willie L. Brown Jr. Middle School takes place in the cafeteria. The choir are all wearing dashikis, and they're led by a man who conducts just as enthusiastically as they sing. This is no typical school cafeteria. It's part of a sparkling new $55 million campus with blonde wood paneling and a full wall of windows that looks out to sweeping views of San Francisco.
I just want to see you standing in the purple rain.
Parents sway and clap, children giggle and whisper. This kind of moment was the hope for the school at the ribbon cutting for the new campus in August 2015.
We are gathered to celebrate the manifestation of a vision that strongly communicates to the children and families of San Francisco that the adults of this city care about their futures.
That's founding principal Demetrius Hobson. The district's strategic plan, called Vision 2025, calls for personalized learning plans for all students. It puts an emphasis on STEM education, science, technology, engineering, and math, to best prepare students for 21st century jobs. It also acknowledges an exodus of children from San Francisco and admits that SFUSD has not always served low-income children of color, like those that live in Bayview, as well as it could have. Here's Superintendent Richard Carranza at another of the school's press events.
The majority of students that were offered a seat to this school actually live in the Bayview neighborhood. And nearly 70% are African-American students or Latino students. So we are reclaiming an educational spot in the Bayview so that students don't feel they have to go outside of the Bayview for a wonderful education.
They're, quote, reclaiming an educational spot because the new Willie Brown Middle School was built on the site of the old Willie Brown College Preparatory Academy. Confusing, I know. When the first Willie Brown opened in 1992, the promises weren't so different. Great teachers, a quality education walking distance from home. But when it closed in 2011, the school was barely functioning. Enrollment was only at around 30% capacity. Test scores were some of the lowest in the state. The building needed $8 million in repairs. So the district decided to tear it down and start again.
When we closed the old Willie Brown facility, we made a promise to this community that we would rebuild it like a phoenix. And it would be the premier middle school, not only in Northern California, but in the state of California, perhaps even in the country.
But despite the high ambitions of the school, its course over the past year has been rocky. When students arrived at the beginning of the year, parts of the campus were still under construction. Founding principal Demetrius Hobson resigned only a month into the school year, and almost a dozen faculty soon followed suit. At the end of September, a group of students, parents, and residents of the neighborhood took their concerns to the school board.
It deserves an F. You know, it failed. It has failed our children. It has failed this community.
And we expected so much, and I feel very deceived.
People talked about total disorganization, about lack of proper supplies. One speaker claims there were no functional phones the first day of school. They say kids were running all over campus without proper supervision. And many speakers touch on a major and basic safety issue, physical violence at school.
In the first day, I ended with a student pushing me and a locker and putting his arm in my neck. For no reason. Why, I thought. Why? I was here for a dream. I had a dream in school. And I get that?
We were sold a dream of how great this would be. I was so excited because I fully believed that this could be the one thing that could stop the violence in our neighborhood. I am so tired. I'm so tired of seeing our children die on the streets.
That last speaker was Rhianda Batiste. She kept her son at Willie Brown, and during the past year, she's gotten involved with the school's PTSA.
Okay, we'll start at the meeting at 5:58.
Several of the parents who were at that board meeting in September have also joined the PTSA to try and solve some of these issues.
We did not do the right work in the opening weeks of school. So it's constantly chasing our tail. We're going backwards in time.
That's current principal Bill Kappenhagen speaking at a PTSA meeting in March. He's talking about the school's lack of a comprehensive behavior policy. Here's PTSA President Dan Harrington.
We need to know what those things are now that the students will be judged on, so we don't wait and waste the rest of the year with just a few students who still aren't acting right, interfering with the education of the majority of the students who are. That's something that the PTSA has been asking.
The answer is, I'm not going to answer this the way you want me to. The answer is you're not going to get anything today. You're not going to get anything today besides the district handbook. You're not.
It's a little tense, and it's complicated. Parents, understandably, want to have rules in place now for their kids. But Kappenhagen stresses that to do these things right, it takes time. And, he stresses to me when I meet with him, things have gotten better.
Since I've been the principal here for about 2.5 months, we've installed systems where systems didn't exist. We have structure and order in the cafeteria, for instance. And on my first days here, we didn't have structure and order in the cafeteria. We also have weekly class meetings. And it's really an opportunity for us to redirect as necessary. And it's also an opportunity for us to build community and culture.
Robotics teacher James Robertson says that kind of building has to happen in the classroom, too.
You could build something where the crank, so you should be looking up here.
I've watched almost everybody have a moment where they shine, but it's not always the same individual. It's not always the person that can memorize and recite and get that perfect A on the test. That's not always the person.
Student Aaron Jones says engineering is one of his favorite classes, and that teachers like Robertson have helped him succeed academically in a way he never has before.
I'm going to an honor roll. I got 2 A pluses, three A's, 3 B's, and 1 C. Me and my dad and all the boys in my family, we have a dyslexia and a disability that makes us like can't speak clearly and understand what other people can, but it's been hard, but I'm going to make it.
Making sure that kids make it means not only boosting academics, but also supporting kids and families in a more holistic way, which is where Willie Brown's Wellness Center comes in.
This one is Unlike any other middle school room, this is the partnership that we have with Department of Public Health, and so we have a...
Amber Goldman is the wellness coordinator and social worker at Willie Brown. She says the school's partnership with the Department of Public Health means they have an on-site nurse practitioner who can do things school nurses can't, like prescribe medication. That's important because it's easily accessible and students don't have to miss school to get checked out.
And often we see with students is that they don't make it to the doctor, or they don't, so they continue to have all these pains. And if they have these pains, then they can't concentrate in class, and they're irritable and everything else. So it's really cool that we have this here.
The Wellness Center had even bigger aspirations, to provide healthcare services to the families of students. But Goldman says that won't be happening in the foreseeable future, although they are hoping to work with Thurgood Marshall High School students. And there have been other promises that have not yet been met. Those personalized learning plans that were such a selling point and major focus in the district's Vision 2025, unclear when those will be in place.
Some pieces have fallen off, and we may be not going back to collect them.
That's PTSA President Dan Harrington again.
Mr. Harrington was a faithful volunteer.
At the appreciation dinner at the end of the school year, Harrington is receiving an award. Harrington is not only the PTSA president. He now works as an educational aide at the school. But despite his obvious commitment, he's conflicted about keeping his son Dominic at Willie Brown.
I want Dominic to graduate from Willie Brown. I don't know that it's going to happen.
Beyond the issues with the school, he's struggling with something that many San Francisco families are dealing with, whether they can even afford to be here. He's a veteran, and his family doesn't have a lot of resources.
Sometimes you wonder, is it all worth it, you know? I could try to take my veteran self and my family somewhere else where it costs a lot less, even though this is my hometown and I've been so dedicated to it.
It's families like these that SFUSD has pledged to support with its Vision 2025. It's clear that Willie Brown Middle School is working hard to fulfill that goal. But what's not clear is whether it'll happen in time for the students that are here now. In Bayview, I'm Nina Gensler-Debs for Cross Currents.
This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Now we're going to meet Lauren Gunderson, a playwright drawn to women from history and the moments of discovery they brought about. Gunderson is one of the most produced playwrights in America these days, but most of her plays premiere right here in her home, the Bay Area. KELW's Jen Chien sat down to talk with her about her work.
You did get a degree in playwriting from New York University, from NYU, but you've made your home and your career here in San Francisco and not New York.
Yeah.
What's behind that? Why not be in that place that everyone thinks is the center of the theater universe?
Yeah. Yeah, it was this incredible discovery for me, the Bay Area, not just for the reasons a lot of people love it, but because of its community here, the art community, which is so rich and so varied. I mean, there are over 300, maybe even more, theater companies in the Bay Area. That's incredible. And that much art, that much innovation. It's a town that likes the new and the next. And so even with classic plays, you have a lot of innovation and a lot of creativity, much less new plays, where, unlike some cities where you have a lot of new work that gets developed and workshopped and they do stage readings, here we do that, but we really want productions. And so I've seen so much of my work premiere here, like on stage. I mean, that's the point of a play, right, is to see it
to
with
do
all the
full
elements.
Show.
Costumes, lights, sound, all the wonderful tools that we have to tell the story well. But I think our taste for new work is really robust here. So I happened to kind of stumble on an amazing city that has done great things for my career.
You've written all kinds of plays, but you have a special love for writing about science, and especially for writing about women scientists. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me more about that?
You know, I learned early on, because I had a great physics teacher in high school, that science was about people and people making the most dramatic choices and having these dramatic moments, which, if you think about what drama is, what makes a great play are these moments of discovery, moments of surprise, moments where you think it's going one way and it goes somewhere else. And that's really science. Those eureka moments, these things that redefine how the world is understood or how the world works or puts the future in action. And I think that's incredibly dramatic, especially when it's paired with, you know, good metaphor. You can have the content, the scientific content, match what the character is going through emotionally, match a kind of, you know, structural world that you're creating in theater. So there's a lot of levels.
What's an example of that?
Well, Tom Stoppard is really great at this, where you'll have, you know, what the character is interested in is some, let's say, math, the math of, like, chaos. And then in their hearts, they're having chaotic feelings, love, loss, you know, all that. And then the structure of the play can be somewhat chaotic, jumping from past to present. So all of those levels can play out. And science just gives us a great vocabulary. And I do think also that people like, audiences tend to like when there is something, quote unquote, real about the art that they're seeing. So it's something that you can go to Wikipedia when you get home and find out more about the scientist or more about this theory or...
Based on a true story.
Yeah, based on a true science.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that makes the art more alive and relevant. And it, you know, a little education isn't bad when you go to the theater too. But certainly for stories of women, I think that it's been really, frankly, easy to write those plays because there is inherently more struggle to a woman's story in something like science, which is traditionally male. And more struggle means more drama. It means, you know, there's more there for her to work against, for her to achieve and to prove wrong. And all those things are very dramatic things, much less the fact that we should know about these women and celebrate them and gives them great models for the future generations of technicians and scientists and thinkers. For me, what's actually most important is to put women's characters on stage, no matter what they are, scientists, mothers, not that they can't be both, everything. Because what I think really changes people's minds, that the power of theater is what you're seeing and that empathy you feel for the characters, even if they're the bad guys or girls. Like, who are the characters that we're empathizing with and understanding and, you know, on the journey with? And if those are more women, it becomes more universal. The human story, we don't think of that immediately as a man's story, and we don't think of women's plays as just for women. Well, they're for everyone. Hamlet isn't a play for men, you know? So I think that's one thing that I definitely love. So many of many more of my plays are with all female casts or mostly female casts, and those have frankly been some of the more successful ones.
That was playwright Lauren Gunderson speaking with KELW's Jen Chien. Gunderson's play, I and You, is running right now at City Lights Theater Company in San Jose and closes June 19th. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba, and now it's time for Audiograph, the Bay Area's sonic signature. Here's KELW's Julie Kane.
All week long, we've been playing you a sound that fills my heart with joy. Think you know what that was and where we recorded it? We sent KALW's Hannah Kingsley Ma out to the outer avenues to find out.
Here's a personal first. I'm staring directly into the face of a one-eyed lemur, willing it to speak. thanks for stopping by and visiting the lemurs of Lemur Forest. And be sure to stop by our other exhibits.
All I can hear is a lawnmower somewhere off in the distance, the cries of seagulls, and the rustling of nearby squirrels. So, not exactly worth the price of admission. It's like this lemur knows I'm waiting for it to make a sound, and is taunting me with its silence. But then, the clock strikes 10. The San Francisco Zoo opens its gates to the public, and lemurs are released into the enclosure. More lemurs start loping out. Some black and white ruffed lemurs, some ringtail lemurs, seven different types live in this exhibit. They start talking to one another. Lemurs are primates, small ones roughly the size of a raccoon. They're nimble, scrambling up a tree with the use of their hands and feet, big bushy tail waving in the air. They have these funny wide eyes that make them look like they're always surprised.
And people are very surprised that an animal that size creates such a loud sound.
That's David Boyshin. He's vice president of animal care at the San Francisco Zoo.
They chorus. When one animal vocalizes, the rest of the group joins in. The rough lemurs live in a dense rainforest, and animals that live in a forest like that, where it's hard to see, often communicate with sound.
Boyshin has a soft spot for these guys.
I think they're very forgiving. I think they're very unusual. They're gentle. I mean, they can be very tough on each other. And that's natural history. That's how animals are. But in general, you know, we go in with these animals. They're not dangerous. They're very accommodating of us. And they follow our rules. They play by the rules. And we give them lots of freedom because of that.
At a zoo, we're used to seeing animals in cages, separated by thick glass or a chain link fence. The Lemur Forest exhibit is open. The lemurs have the lay of the land. From an elevated wooden deck, you can watch them clamber up high and hang out on wide nets, all on top of each other in one big lemur cuddle puddle.
If I were a zoo lemur, this is where I'd want to be.
One of the lemurs takes a wild leap from a branch. The crowd, an assorted group of preschoolers on a field trip, goes wild.
Look at that! That leg is like, it's like,
look at that!
The lemurs, they have a lot of character. People like them. And Boyshin thinks that charm serves a greater purpose.
You know, there's a powerful story to tell here.
These lemurs were bred in captivity, but in the wild, they're only found in Madagascar. The island is home to an amazing array of animal and plant species, but it's also experienced rampant deforestation over the last century, endangering a lot of the wildlife that it hosts. There are more than 100 lemur species, and over a fifth of them are critically endangered.
If anyone comes to see this exhibit, they should use it as a springboard to learn more about Madagascar and about conservation in general.
They are considered to have evolved earlier and separately than monkeys and apes. In the wild, they can only be found in Madagascar, where they live in groups similar to what you see here. It's not unusual for lemurs in the wild to live together or near other types of lemurs. So what you see in Lemur Forest is very natural.
So is what you hear. The lemurs don't vocalize often. But when they do, everyone looks around in total surprise, trying to figure out what that sound could have come from.
Those are the animals that were making the noise?
Yeah.
Kind of like loud seals, like yapping, kind of like on a beach or something.
Kind of like a hamster?
They don't seem to make any noises.
I would have thought of a bigger animal would have made that sound.
At their best, zoos are places where we get to check out animals we might never get a chance to see otherwise. But they're also a place for us to examine our own relationship with wilderness, what ways we impact it, and what influence we can have. So it makes sense, then, that in a space like this, we're both part of the conversation.
We're talking to you.
For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Kingsley-Mott.
This was a tough sound to guess, and actually, nobody got it this week. But that's okay, don't feel bad. I mean, lemurs. Who knew? Do you have other mysterious sounds you'd like us to know about? Give us a call and tell us. 415-264-7106.
That's 415-264-7106. We love hearing from you. Thanks so much for listening, and thanks for playing. I'm Julie Kane.
Thanks, Julie. If you love Audiograph and really try hard to solve them every week, well, you definitely need to subscribe to our podcast. You can hear more Audiographs and catch up on past episodes of Cross Currents. It's all there at kalw.org/subscribe. Oh, and one thing you don't know is this show is sometimes made by a bunch of lemurs. No, for real. There's Shireen Adil, Lila Day, Audrey Dilling, Nina Gensler-Debs, Chris Hoff, Angela Johnston, Ian Lewis, Casey Miner, Ted Muldoon, Raja Shah, and Stephen Short is even a lemur. Today's show is engineered by James Rollins. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. Today's local music is by Matt Jaffe and the Distractions. Jaffe's musical influences are wide-ranging, from The Clash to Hank Williams. Matt Jaffe and the Distractions will be at Sweetwater Music Hall in Matt's hometown of Mill Valley on Monday night. Doors open at 7 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba. Have monitors that show us pictures.